Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Assembling Life, How Can Life Begin on Earth and Other Habitable Planets? By David Deamer. Read by Stephen R. Thorne. Preface. In 1964, long before the Internet gave instant access to the accumulated knowledge of humankind, it was necessary to actually visit a library full of books, thumb through a thick volume of chemical abstracts to find the desired citation, and then trudge up several flights of stairs to crack open the bound volume in which the desired paper was embedded. The article I wanted was in Archives of Biochemistry and Biophysics, and while leafing through the pages, I happened to see the title Synthesis of Purines Under Possible Primitive Earth Conditions. As a novice biochemist, I knew that purines were components of nucleic acids, but I had never before heard the phrase primitive earth. What could that mean? I began to read and was fascinated. Someone named John Oro at the University of Houston had discovered that adenine was a pentamer of hydrogen cyanide, and that this simple reaction could have provided one of the essential nucleobases required for life to begin. My curiosity satisfied, I found the paper I needed, took notes by hand because photocopiers had not yet been invented, and then returned to the lab where I was studying how calcium ions interact with fatty acid monolayers. I would never have imagined that 15 years later I would be visiting Oro in Houston and writing a paper with him on how lipid membranes could have been involved in life's beginning. The study of life's origins was, in the 1960s and 1970s, on the fringes of scientific research, and may still be yet, although inroads are being made. As I went through postdoctoral studies at University of California, Berkeley, and then began my academic career at UC Davis, I did not give it another thought. The topic was definitely not something a young assistant professor who wanted to impress senior colleagues and be awarded a tenured position should get interested in. Instead, my research was focused on biological membranes of mitochondria, chloroplasts, and sarcoplasmic reticulum, using the new technique of freeze fracture electron microscopy to study their structure and function. By 1975, I was a tenured associate professor and decided to celebrate by taking a sabbatical to learn more about the membrane models called liposomes. These models had been developed by the British researcher Alec Bangham, so our little family of four traveled to Cambridge, England, found a home to rent, and every morning I rode a red double-decker bus to Babraham, where Alec had his laboratory at the Animal Physiology Institute. I have much to say about the discoveries we made over the next 6 months. Too much for this preface. What I will recount is a conversation with Alec while we were driving down to London in his Morris Mini. I don't recall the details, but somewhere along the way we stopped for a picnic lunch alongside the road. I was curious about a talk Alec had given at the University of Bristol with the title Membranes Came First. During our conversation, we realized that there was a vast gap in our understanding. What were the first lipids, and how did they assemble into membrane compartments required for the first forms of life? I took that question home with me. 40 years later, the seed planted by that question has sprouted and grown into what might be called a shrub. In other words, I can describe multiple branches related to a few answers to the main question— but there is not yet a central trunk of consensus that could be called a tree. This book describes the growth process of this shrub in a certain way, because during those 40 years I also wrote two textbooks, the first about human physiology and the second about cell biology. The textbook style, for better or worse, permeates the style that I have chosen to present information in this book. In other words, the author of a textbook tries to be as clear as possible by providing an introduction to each chapter, a list of questions to be addressed, and then the main discussion followed by a summary with conclusions at the end. My impression is that even experts in origins of life research will benefit from the textbook style. Certainly, it helped me keep my thought processes on track as I wrote. As a final word, I must confess to writing an earlier book about the origin of life. First Life was published in 2010 by the University of California Press. Just 8 years later, why should I write another? First Life was what is called a trade book, written for readers who did not have scientific training, but were still interested in the question of life's beginning. Assembling Life is a heftier monograph written for the scientific community. Why heftier? Well, throughout the book, there are references to scientific literature. There are even a few equations in Chapter 6. But more important, a lot has happened in the 8 years since First Life was published, such as the discovery of liquid water on Enceladus and the consensus that Mars once had lakes and rivers. What are the chances that life could begin elsewhere on other planetary bodies in the solar system? That alone is worth writing about. I also try to make this book interesting and understandable. It is not intended to be a highly detailed compendium reviewing research on the origin of life with 1,000 or more citations in a reference section. Instead, the book describes a personal map of largely unexplored territory that encompasses the research I have carried out with colleagues and in collaboration with talented undergraduates, graduate students, and postdoctoral scholars. When I do refer to the research of other scientists, the citations are landmarks that have guided the map-making process. The goal is to construct a coherent narrative in the form of a testable hypothesis that suggests a set of critical experiments. My intention is not to show how life did begin on Earth, because we can never know that with certainty. Instead, the goal is to propose how life can begin on any habitable planet, with the Earth, so far, being the only known example. Introduction. It was unthinkable, not long ago, that a biologist or paleontologist would be at the same conference as an astrophysicist. Now, we have accumulated so much data in each of these branches of science, as it relates to origins, that we have learned that no one discipline can answer questions of origins alone. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Conjectures, Hypotheses, and Consensus. In origins of life research, it is important to understand the difference between conjecture and hypothesis. All ideas begin as conjectures, defined as opinions based on insufficient evidence. A conjecture becomes a hypothesis when it is possible to devise experiments or observations that test an idea, or falsify it, using the terminology of Karl Popper. All too often, two scientists come up with conjectures that are incompatible in some way, and controversy ensues. My advice to the scientists engaged in such a controversy is not to argue back and forth with claims of correctness and plausibility, but instead to accept that the two ideas are best investigated as alternative hypotheses, as first defined by John Platt. Testing alternative hypotheses avoids the human tendency to fall in love with and try to protect a precious idea. Instead, the weight of evidence that accrues from the tests gives value to both positive and negative results. At some point, the weight of evidence convinces colleagues, just as evidence convinces jurors in a trial, and a consensus is reached that one of the alternative hypotheses has more explanatory power. This book will describe a number of aspects regarding the origin of life that are currently controversial. For instance, which came first, metabolism or genes? Can life exist in the absence of membranous compartments? More specifically, did life begin in the ocean, in salty seawater, or in freshwater, on terrestrial landmasses? The last question is particularly important because an answer has ramifications related to the origin of life on other planetary bodies that will be described in Chapter 12. To make this clear, I will show how alternative conjectures can arise from a factual basis. The first conjecture follows from the discovery of hydrothermal vents and observations related to their properties. Facts: all life requires liquid water. Most of the water on Earth is in the ocean. Hydrothermal vents emerging from the ocean floor are sources of chemical energy. Populations of chemotrophic microbial life thrive in hydrothermal vents. Conjecture: life originated in hydrothermal vents and later adapted to fresh water on volcanic and continental landmasses. In the absence of alternatives, this idea has been accepted as a reasonable proposal. Here is an alternative to a marine origin of life. Facts: a small fraction of the Earth's water is distilled from seawater and precipitates as fresh water on volcanic landmasses. The water accumulates in hydrothermal fields that undergo cycles of evaporation and refilling. During evaporation, dilute solutes in the water become concentrated films on mineral surfaces. If the solutes can undergo chemical or physical interactions, they will do so in the concentrated films. The products will accumulate in the pools when water returns, either in the form of precipitation or as fluctuations in water levels related to hot springs or geyser activity. Conjecture: life originated in freshwater hydrothermal fields associated with volcanic landmasses, then later adapted to the salty seawater of the early ocean. Throughout this book, I will be treating these conjectures as alternatives and will present the weight of evidence related to each hypothesis. The Early Earth: Facts, Assumptions, and Plausibility. I don't recall who told me this, but years ago I was given sound advice about presenting scientific talks, which goes something like this. First, tell 'em what you'll tell 'em, then tell 'em, then tell 'em what you told 'em. Following that advice, here is my personal scenario for the first three chapters of this book, based on idiosyncratic estimates of the plausibility of the various conditions. Not everyone will agree with the guesswork, but we must start somewhere in order to design experimental tests of ideas. The first physical and chemical steps toward living systems began after the global temperature had fallen sufficiently for an ocean to condense from water vapor. Therefore, it is likely that cellular life emerged in conditions much warmer than today's global temperature of 15 degrees Celsius. The ocean was already salty, with volcanic landmasses emerging into an atmosphere mostly composed of nitrogen and a smaller fraction of carbon dioxide. The landmasses resembled Hawaii and Iceland today, caused by magma plumes heating the Earth's crust and producing volcanic islands. Evidence for similar ancient volcanoes on Mars include Apollinaris Mons, estimated to have been active approximately 3.5 billion years ago. Hydrothermal chemistry is a plausible way to develop the complexity required for life to begin. Two hydrothermal sites have been proposed as sites for the origin of life: submarine hydrothermal vents and hydrothermal fields associated with volcanic landmasses. Hydrothermal vents emerge into salty seawater and have free energy available in the form of reducing power, pH gradients, and thermal gradients. Hydrothermal fields associated with volcanism are supplied with fresh water distilled from salty seawater and falling onto landmasses as precipitation. Contemporary examples include the hydrothermal fields I have investigated in Kamchatka, Hawaii, Iceland, New Zealand, and Yellowstone National Park. Based on what we see today, it is reasonable to assume that the earliest pools were heated by geothermal energy and ranged in size from puddles with volumes of a few liters to larger ponds fed by geysers, hot springs, and cyclic precipitation. With those assumptions in place, a set of biological properties can be presented as a list that illustrates the complexity of life and brings us to a fundamental question of biology. All life today exists in a steady state away from equilibrium, is based on polymers that are synthesized by condensation reactions, uses energy from the environment to drive polymerization and growth, experiences wet-dry cycles, microbial spores, seeds of higher plants, tardigrades, can thrive in elevated temperature ranges, employs catalysts and metabolic pathways, uses light as a primary source of energy, requires genetic information, is based on cellular compartments, grows by polymerization, uses feedback regulation to control life processes, divides into daughter cells, exists as populations of cells, microbial mats, tissues, evolves over time toward ever-increasing complexity. Here is the question. How could such complex systems begin on a sterile early Earth? Many more details need to be worked out in a continuing research effort before we can reach a consensus about the physical and chemical environment of the prebiotic Earth from which life emerged. To this end, I will explore what we know with a reasonable degree of confidence, then point the way toward the next level in which seemingly unrelated details could coalesce into a comprehensive map that will let us understand how life can begin on a habitable planet. Chapter 1. The Early Earth, an Ocean with Volcanoes. If we had a time machine and could travel to the ancient Pilbara, we would see great volcanoes emerging from the sea and small areas of other land, but no continent. It would have looked like the Hawaiian Islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, but with little sign of life. No trees, no grass, no animals, no surfers on the beach. Malcolm Walter. Overview and questions to be addressed. Malcolm Walter was talking about the Pilbara region of Western Australia, where some of the oldest known biosignatures of ancient life, in the form of extensive fossilized stromatolites, are preserved. The first potential stromatolite was discovered by graduate student John Dunlop, who was studying barite deposits at the North Pole Dome. Roger Buick went on to investigate the biogenicity of the stromatolites for his PhD, and Dunlop, Buick, and Walter published their results. In a prescient paper, Walter and Desmarais proposed that the ancient stromatolite fossils could guide the search for life on Mars. I have walked with Malcolm Walter through the Dresser Formation where the fossils were found. It is humbling to realize that if time passed at 1,000 years per second, it would take 41 days to go back in time to the first signs of life on our planet. In any description of events that occurred some 4 billion years ago, certain assumptions must be made. I will try to make assumptions explicit throughout this book, beginning here with the geochemical and geophysical conditions prevailing on the early Earth and Mars. I am including Mars not as an afterthought, but because both planets had liquid water 4 billion years ago. Most of our understanding of planetary evolution comes from observations of our own planet, but it is now clear that the Earth and Mars were undergoing similar geophysical processes during the first billion years of the solar system's existence, with an equal probability that life could begin on either planet. In a sense, the surface of Mars is a geological fossil that has preserved evidence of what was happening there at the same time that life began on the Earth. For instance, Martian volcanoes offer direct, observable evidence that volcanism was occurring nearly 4 billion years ago, making it plausible that similar volcanism was common on Earth, even though the evidence has been completely erased by geological and tectonic processes. I have often noticed that papers related to the origin of life tend to assume that water is simply a liquid solvent with little attention paid to its properties. The main point to be made in this chapter is that if water is essential for the origin of life, it is important to understand the source of the water, the time at which it first appeared, the geophysical environment of the first hydrosphere, and the chemical composition of the water. There are two primary aqueous bulk phases today, and a reasonable assumption is that this was also true 4 billion years ago. A major fraction would be salty seawater in the original global ocean, but a smaller fraction was present as water distilled from the ocean and precipitated on volcanic islands to form freshwater sites characterized by geysers, hot springs, and associated hydrothermal fields. Questions to be addressed in Chapter 1. Where did the Earth's water come from? When did the ocean appear? How salty was the ocean? Was there also fresh water on the prebiotic Earth? Sources of the Earth's water. In one way or another, I have been associated with NASA-sponsored research since the 1980s, when I served on the peer review panel for the Exobiology program. As I watched exobiology grow and evolve into astrobiology, with the expectation that we might find life on other planets, there was a central rule: look for liquid water. Even though water is integral to life on Earth, there is a surprising degree of uncertainty about its source. There is no doubt that water is a common constituent of the interstellar medium because its characteristic spectrum is readily distinguished in the microwave region when radio astronomers observe the molecular clouds that give rise to stars and solar systems. Much of the water is present as thin layers of mixed ice on interstellar dust particles, along with ammonia, carbon monoxide, and methanol. Therefore, as gravity caused dust particles in the original solar nebula to aggregate, the water ice was mixed with a variety of carbon compounds and integrated into planetesimals and comets, then delivered to planetary surfaces during the accretion process by which planets like the Earth and Mars formed. The story begins with the final phase of accretion that took place after approximately 90% of the Earth's mass was already present. During this phase, a Mars-sized planet collided with the proto-Earth to add the last 10% of the Earth's mass. The violent collision produced a splash of molten rock and vapor that formed a ring around the Earth resembling that of Saturn, and this material gathered by gravitational forces into the Moon. This idea was recently challenged because the compositions of the lunar and terrestrial minerals are very similar. Instead of a single collision between planets, perhaps a series of smaller objects impacted the Earth, mixing into the surface and also splashing material into a disk from which the Moon formed. Whichever scenario is correct does not affect the narrative being presented in this book, because in either case, so much energy was released that the surfaces of the Earth and Moon were magma oceans at the temperature of molten volcanic lava. The energy of the impacts also eroded most of the volatile compounds in the original atmosphere, leaving behind a steam atmosphere with significant components of nitrogen gas and carbon dioxide. An important point is that no organic compounds could have survived this temperature range, so all of the organics required for life to begin must have become available only after the Earth cooled sufficiently for an ocean to condense from an atmosphere of water vapor. There are two plausible sources that will be discussed in detail in Chapter 4. The required organic material could have been synthesized at the Earth's surface by geochemical and photochemical reactions, or delivered during late accretion as meteoritic infall and comets. Most likely, both sources contributed to the suite of organic compounds, but in either case, the compounds would undergo processing by secondary chemical reactions at the Earth's surface and atmosphere before being caught up in the chemical evolution leading to life. There are also two possible sources of the Earth's water: comets impacting the cooling Earth after the moon-forming phase, and volcanic outgassing from the Earth's interior. Comets are at one end of the mineral water spectrum, typically composed of water ice mixed with smaller amounts of mineral dust. Almost certainly, comets did contribute some of the Earth's water, but they were probably not the primary source. Some insight comes from comparisons of the isotopic composition of seawater and cometary ice. There are two general classes of comets, depending on whether they originated in the Kuiper Belt or Oort cloud. The deuterium-hydrogen ratio of a few comets has been determined, and this can be compared to terrestrial seawater. If the deuterium-hydrogen ratios match those of comets, a reasonable conclusion would be that the ocean is largely cometary in origin. However, the initial indications are that, with one exception, the deuterium-hydrogen ratios of comets do not perfectly match that of seawater, but instead match the deuterium-hydrogen ratios of the water in carbonaceous meteorites. The tentative conclusion is that the major source of the Earth's water was not delivered by comets, but by impacting planetesimals during primary accretion. This is supported by recent evidence. Previous measurements of the deuterium-hydrogen ratio in other comets have shown a wide range of values. Of the 11 comets for which measurements have been made, it is only the Jupiter-family comet 103P Hartley II that was found to match the composition of Earth's water in observations made by ESA's Herschel mission in 2011. By contrast, meteorites originally hailing from asteroids in the asteroid belt also match the composition of Earth's water. Thus, despite the fact that asteroids have a much lower overall water content, impacts by a large number of them could still have resulted in Earth's oceans. It is against this backdrop that Rosetta's investigations are important. Interestingly, the deuterium-hydrogen ratio measured by the Rosetta Orbiter Spectrometer for Ion and Neutral Analysis, or ROSINA, is more than 3 times greater than for Earth's oceans and for its Jupiter-family companion, Comet Hartley II. Indeed, it is even higher than measured for any Oort cloud comet as well. The planetesimals impacting the Earth during the accretion phase were composed of a variety of stony minerals and metallic elements mixed with water ice and organic compounds. A tiny fraction of planetesimals escaped planet formation and are still orbiting the Sun as asteroids between Mars and Jupiter, ranging in size from tens of meters to a few like Ceres and Vesta that have diameters of hundreds of kilometers. Smaller asteroids are loose aggregates composed of dust and sand-sized minerals mixed with small amounts of water ice. The interiors of larger asteroids were heated by radioactive decay, getting hot enough to melt iron and nickel and undergoing differentiation as the molten metals sank into a core, leaving behind a rocky crust. Asteroids are constantly colliding with one another, and as a result of the impacts, smaller pieces are ejected into the surrounding space. Most of these simply continue to orbit within the belt, but a rare few fall sunward and intersect the Earth's orbit. If they survive the fiery trip through the atmosphere and fall to the Earth's surface, they are called meteorites. Because asteroids assembled very early in solar system history, approximately 4.6 billion years ago, meteorites derived from collisions between asteroids provide the richest source of information we have about the composition of the asteroid parent bodies. Most meteorites are stony, a few are metallic, composed of a nickel-iron alloy, and a small fraction are carbonaceous, containing a complex suite of organic compounds. This is the most convincing evidence that biologically relevant compounds can be synthesized by non-biological processes. Later in the book, we will use carbonaceous meteorites as a guide to the kinds of organic compounds that were plausibly available in the prebiotic environment of our planet. It is certain that all of the biogenetic elements, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur, now present on the Earth, were delivered by planetesimals during primary accretion. Along with water, delivery included the silicate minerals of the mantle and crust, and the iron-nickel mixture that sank to the core as a molten metal. Compounds related to the origin of life were certainly present, along with silicate minerals and metallic iron and nickel. However, none of the more complex organic molecules could survive the temperatures of primary accretion and the moon-forming event, so the composition of the Earth's surface would simply be the most stable compounds that survived the process, including molecular nitrogen and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The first liquid water. Even though the ocean seems vast, in fact, it is a very thin layer of water coating a mass of rocky mineral crust. If the Earth were the size of a basketball, 25 centimeters in diameter, the ocean would
Sample complete. Ready to continue?